KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Hundreds of thousands of Bostonians line the streets to hand the runners cups of water and to cheer them on. It was a beautiful day to be in Boston. A day that explains why a poet once wrote that this town is not just a capital, not just a place. Boston, he said, is the perfect state of grace. And then, in an instant, the day's beauty was shattered. A celebration became a tragedy. And so we come together to pray and mourn and measure our loss. But we also come together today to reclaim that state of grace, to reaffirm that the spirit of this city is undaunted, and the spirit of this country shall remain undimmed. To Governor Patrick, Mayor Menino, Cardinal O'Malley, and all the faith leaders who are here, Governors Romney, Swift, Weld, and Dukakis, members of Congress, and most of all, the people of Boston and the families who've lost a piece of your heart, we thank you for your leadership. We thank you for your courage. We thank you for your grace. I'm here today on behalf of the American people with a simple message. Every one of us has been touched by this attack on your beloved city. Every one of us stands with you. Because after all, it's our beloved city too. Boston may be your hometown, but we claim it too. It's one of America's iconic cities. It's one of the world's great cities. And one of the reasons the world knows Boston so well is that Boston opens its heart to the world. Over successive generations, you've welcomed again and again new arrivals to our shores. Immigrants who constantly reinvigorated this city and this commonwealth and our nation. Every fall, you welcome students from all across America and all across the globe. And every spring, you graduate them back into the world, a Boston diaspora that excels in every field of human endeavor. Year after year, you welcome the greatest talents in the arts and science, research. You welcome them to your concert halls and your hospitals and your laboratories to exchange ideas and insights that draw this world together. And every third Monday in April, you welcome people from all around the world to the hub for friendship and fellowship and healthy competition. A gathering of men and women of every race and every religion, every shape and every size. A multitude represented by all those flags that flew over the finish line. So whether folks come here to Boston for just a day, or they stay here for years, they leave with a piece of this town tucked firmly into their hearts. So Boston's your hometown, but we claim it a little bit too. I know this. I know this because there's a piece of Boston in me. You welcomed me as a young law student across the river. Welcomed Michelle, too. You welcomed me. You welcomed me during a convention when I was still a state senator and very few people could pronounce my name right. Like you, Michelle and I have walked these streets. Like you, we know these neighborhoods. And like you, in this moment of grief, we join you in saying, Boston, you're my home. For millions of us, what happened on Monday is personal. It's personal. Today, our prayers are with the Campbell family of Medford. They're here today. Their daughter, Crystal, was always smiling. Those who knew her said that with her red hair and her freckles and her ever eager willingness to speak her mind, she was beautiful. Sometimes she could be a little noisy. And everybody loved her for it. She would have turned 30 next month. As her mother said through her tears, this doesn't make any sense. Our prayers are with the Liu family of China, who sent their daughter, Lingzi, to BU so that she could experience all that this city has to offer. She was a 23-year-old student, far from home, and in the heartache of her family and friends on both sides of a great ocean, we're reminded of the humanity that we all share. Our prayers are with the Richard family of Dorchester, to Denise and their young daughter Jane, as they fight to recover. And our hearts are broken for 8-year-old Martin with his big smile and bright eyes. His last hours were as perfect as an 8-year-old boy could hope for, with his family eating ice cream at a sporting event. And we're left with two enduring images of this little boy, forever smiling for his beloved Bruins and forever expressing a wish he made on a blue poster board. No more hurting people. Peace. No more hurting people. Peace. Our prayers are with the injured. So many wounded, some gravely. From their beds, some are surely watching us gather here today. And if you are, know this. As you begin this long journey of recovery, your city is with you. Your commonwealth is with you. Your country is with you. We will all be with you as you learn to stand and walk and, yes, run again. Of that, I have no doubt you will run again. You will run again. Because that's what the people of Boston are made of. Your resolve is the greatest rebuke to whoever committed this heinous act. If they sought to intimidate us, to terrorize us, to shake us from those values that Deval described, the values that make us who we are as Americans, well, it should be pretty clear by now that they picked the wrong city to do it. Not here in Boston. Not here in Boston. You've shown us, Boston, that in the face of evil, Americans will lift up what's good. In the face of cruelty, we will choose compassion. In the face of those who would visit death upon innocence, we will choose to save and to comfort and to heal. We'll choose friendship. We'll choose love. For Scripture teaches us, God has not given us a spirit of fear and timidity, but of power, love, and self-discipline. And that's the spirit you've displayed in recent days. When doctors and nurses, police and firefighters and EMTs and guardsmen run towards explosions to treat the wounded, that's discipline. When exhausted runners, including our troops and veterans who never expected to see such carnage on the streets back home, become first responders themselves, tending to the injured. That's real power. When Bostonians carry victims in their arms, deliver water and blankets, line up to give blood, open their homes to total strangers, give them rides back to reunite with their families, that's love. That's the message we send to those who carry this out and anyone who would do harm to our people. Yes, we will find you. And yes, you will face justice. We will find you, we will hold you accountable, but more than that, our fidelity to our way of life, to our free and open society, will only grow stronger. For God has not given us a spirit of fear and timidity, but one of power and love and self-discipline. Like Bill Ifrit, 78 years old, the runner in the orange tank top who we all saw get knocked down by the blast, we may be momentarily knocked off our feet. But we'll pick ourselves up. We'll keep going. We will finish the race. In the words of Dick Hoyt, who's pushed his disabled son, Rick, in 31 Boston marathons, we can't let something like this stop us. This doesn't stop us. And that's what you've taught us, Boston. That's what you've reminded us. To push on. To persevere. to not grow weary, to not get faint, even when it hurts, even when our heart aches, we summon the strength that maybe we didn't even know we had, and we carry on. We finish the race. We finish the race. And we do that because of who we are. And we do that because we know that somewhere around the bend, a stranger has a cup of water. Around the bend, somebody's there to boost our spirits. On that toughest mile, just when we think that we've hit a wall, someone will be there to cheer us on and pick us up if we fall. We know that. And that's what the perpetrators of such senseless violence, these small, stunted individuals who would destroy instead of build and think somehow that makes them important, that's what they don't understand. Our faith in each other, our love for each other, our love for country, our common creed that cuts across whatever superficial differences there may be, that is our power. That's our strength. That's why a bomb can't beat us. That's why we don't hunker down. That's why we don't cower in fear. We carry on. We race. We strive. We build and we work and we love and we raise our kids to do the same, and we come together to celebrate life and to walk our cities and to cheer for our teams when the Sox and Celtics and Patriots or Bruins are champions again, to the chagrin of New York and Chicago fans. The crowds will gather and watch a parade go down Boylston Street. And this time next year, on the third Monday in April, the world will return to this great American city to run harder than ever and to cheer even louder for the 118th Boston Marathon. Bet on it. Tomorrow, the sun will rise over Boston. Tomorrow, the sun will rise over this country that we love. This special place. This state of grace. Scripture tells us to run with endurance the race that is set before us. As we do, may God hold close those who've been taken from us too soon. May He comfort their families. And may He continue to watch over these United States of America.
President Barack Obama speaking at the special Boston Marathon Bombing Interfaith Healing Service at the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston. This is special coverage of that service from WBUR in Boston. Coming up, Cardinal Sean O'Malley with a closing blessing, and then America the Beautiful.
This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle.
As we come to the conclusion of our prayer service this morning, just a reminder to everyone here in the cathedral to remain in their places until the President and Mrs. Obama have securely exited the building. I invite you to kindly stand now for our concluding blessing.
The Lord be with you. Let us pray. May the Lord preserve your going forth and your coming in. May the Lord bless you and protect you. May the Lord smile on you and be gracious to you. May the Lord show you his favor and give you his peace. Amen.
Special coverage from Boston of the memorial service for the victims of Monday's bombings. This is KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, celebrating 75 years of King County Parks by establishing the King County Parks Foundation, devoted to strengthening families and connecting communities for generations to come. Information on contributing at loveourparks.org.
We do a lot of bomb sweeps at Safeco Field for the Mariner games, CenturyLink Field for the Seahawks games. We go to about 200 calls a year.
The greatest threats to our waterways are often invisible to the naked eye. Evidence crops up in unlikely places, like Alki Beach, across Elliott Bay from downtown Seattle.
We're going to take a look at what's happening in Puget Sound and what we're dealing with in terms of bomb investigations. Good morning. It's weekday. Following that special coverage, I'm Steve Scher. Thank you for joining us. Investigators are trying to piece together how and why the bombings at the Boston Marathon occurred. So we were wondering after an explosion, what clues are detectives looking for and how are unexploded bombs found and disarmed? Detective Randy Curtis is a bomb technician, underwater explosives recovery specialist for the Seattle Police Department. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, sir.
And Craig Williamson is explosives detection canine officer for the Seattle Police Department. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
And quietly on the floor, but later to be making some noise, I'm sure, is Dennis, the Yellow Lab officer, who works as an explosives detection canine. And he is, as we were talking about, he is a full-fledged officer of the Seattle Police Department.
That's right. That's right.
He's got a badge.
A badge. He's been an officer for 3 years now, over 3 years.
And he's a working dog, a working yellow lab, and a very friendly fellow.
Oh, very, very.
I would like to work backwards, if I can, from what happens when something's exploded and how you proceed as a bomb tech. Because one of the images that we saw over the last few days was this pressure cooker lid.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that was found, the media was going up. We have something that we know was part of the bomb. Other than the media, how do we know that's part of the bomb? Is it because a dog smelled it or because it's something out of place?
You start at the seat of the blast and you have the greatest amount of devastation. You work out from there to try to determine the boundaries of where you think evidence might have been hurled, be it fragmentation from the actual device or from the victims themselves. The victims, unfortunately, also are receptacles of evidence. Things that were thrown out of that bomb are now, unfortunately, embedded in victims.
Yeah, we were hearing that from the reports, too, weren't we?
So you have to have technicians and evident people, crime scene investigators, that'll go to the hospitals, and you need to document and place each of these items in a secure environment so that we can use them when you go to trial and you want to start putting together the device. You have to determine where the greatest amount of damage occurred, if you work out, and then start coming in to try to eliminate what was originally there benign and then what was introduced by the evildoer.
You know, when you see the videos, in this case, you see so many specific videos from so many different angles. Does that jumpstart the investigation because you have images of where the bomb was?
Oh, without a doubt. You have the images, and you're also going to be asking the witnesses, what did you see, smell, all of the senses that you can take into effect. You utilize in putting together what the device components might have been.
What are people telling you when you ask them, what did you smell? You've been on sites. What kind of answers do you get?
Depending on what the explosive components were, you can have an entirely, was there any type of gasoline or a motor oil? Did it smell similar to what you might have, put on your lawn during the summer? And then you're leaning towards an ammonia nitrate type.
So these detectives that are in Boston right now, mm-hmm. they are, what are we, how many days are we on this? 3 days. What are they doing on the scene still? Are they still combing for evidence on the scene at this point?
Still conducting a very thorough post-blast, we call it, where they're attempting to identify each item that you come across on that street and attempt to identify, was it there originally? Is it part of the event, the Boston Marathon, or could it have come from the parcel that held the explosive device itself?
What have you read about what we know about the bomb? What do you feel we've learned just as somebody who's reading the papers like the rest of us?
Yeah.
What have you learned about what this bomb was?
Looks like it was contained in a pressure cooker, which is just very simply the vessel utilized. They're made to withstand a certain amount of pressure, and they're not unlike a pipe bomb. They're ideal because they can withstand a certain amount of pressure before that vessel ruptures. And so you have a device that was placed inside this cooker, brought into the environment by someone in a backpack or satchel, and left behind to do its evilness.
Detective Randy Curtis is a bomb tech. By the way, do you feel that way? You've explored enough of these bombs. How do you feel about, you've already alluded to it, how do you feel about these bombs? Evil?
Oh, undoubtedly. Yeah. On a major scale.
Yeah. You have to confront that every day in your work.
You do. We have some of the best training that's ever given. The FBI, initially, as you become a bomb technician, you're sent to lovely Redstone Arsenal in Alabama for a very intense school that's taught jointly by the FBI and the U.S. Army. And every year, in order to maintain our accreditation as a bomb technician, you have to leave the comfort of your home. You have to go away to another city, and you're learning the different new techniques that are being utilized all around the world by terrorists, both domestic and foreign. So our training is constant and nonstop. Every 3 years, I go back to lovely Redstone Arsenal, and I have recertification courses that run Monday through Friday. It's testing each day on different components that we're to be efficient on and know all about.
Have you interviewed or caught people who have placed bombs?
Unfortunately, yes.
Are they of a particular difference as a criminal than the others you've met?
No. Their reasoning is no different than any other individuals for having committed a crime. They thought that this was the best opportunity that was afforded at the time. And it's an entirely different mindscape to think of putting together a device that has such devastating effects on the human body.
The bomb that went off in Boston was terrible.
Well, bombs in general are horrible. Yeah. Our bodies weren't made to withstand that type of devastating shock and post-blast. The wave that emits from a bomb, the heat, the temperature, it's devastating on our little bodies.
We talked to Bill Ifrig. The president mentioned him. Bill Ifrig was running and from Lake Stevens, and the wave knocked him over.
Yeah.
He didn't get touched by any of the bomb fragments, but he was knocked over by that wave.
The positive blast wave is immense. It's just the natural physics of air wanting to get away from that explosion. And then there's the negative wave that's going to be the replacement of the oxygen or the air coming back into that environment, which can be just as devastating.
Really?
Yeah.
Detective Randy Curtis is a bomb technician, underwater explosives recovery specialist for the Seattle Police Department. Boy, that's a whole other division, isn't it? Craig Williamson is explosives detection canine officer for the Seattle Police Department. I guess I have that same question to you to start with. Have you encountered a person who has placed the bomb?
No. We've never encountered someone that's placed the bomb. We use the dog in a pre-event sweep type of atmosphere, maybe at Safeco Field, or if a dignitary's coming to town, where we'll search maybe some motorcade vehicles, or where he'll be staying, where he'll be speaking. We also use them for crime scene searches. So we're usually ahead of the game where someone's going to be in an atmosphere like that.
Crime scene searches?
Crime scene searches, post-blast, what you were just referring to, when the bomb has gone off, we can use the dog after the bomb has gone off to find the components. In an urban atmosphere, it's a little bit more difficult. Say in Boston, where it's in the heart of downtown and things are falling on the street, or maybe the pressure lid fell on the roof, it may be a little bit more difficult. Dog could be more useful in, say, a city park where someone's exploded a sparkler bomb, or a bomb that's sent components off into fields of ivy or grass that can't be seen. You know, the dog doesn't need his eyes. He's using his nose.
But I did see that. Well, actually, let me start with this question. We got an email from a listener who said there seemed to be a lot of security already at the Boston Marathon, because soon after the bomb went off, I saw somebody with the dog. I saw police officers. In general, even on these events that seem open, there is security.
There is. I'm sure, a high level of security when you get a lot of people involved with an event such as a marathon, Seafair.
Seafair has security. You guys are
exactly
there all the time, right?
Exactly.
For a torchlight parade, it's the same thing. We'll have an incredible police presence, but by the very nature of our city, you can't lock it down. We can't ask everyone to leave their purses and backpacks and large wallets at home. It's the freedom of, you know, being in America that we can't just start going through everyone's bags.
Do our best with the training that we have and the tools that we can use to keep people safe.
Well, we see the dogs. If you're taking the ferry, you see the dogs all the time.
That's right.
Before they're getting on the ferry. What is Dennis, or what are those dogs, what are they actually smelling?
They're smelling the ingredients, if nothing else, for the explosives that they're putting in the pressure cooker, whether it's black powder, smokeless powder, ammonium nitrate, high explosives, whatever it is. Dennis is trained to find upwards of 19,000 explosive combinations.
Whoa. Keeps him from being confused with that many combinations?
Well, daily training. Every day is spent training with him and to take him to a degree that he's capable of finding the explosive odors that we want him to. There are common things that the dog can alert on that are also used. Ammonium nitrate, you know, it's a lawn fertilizer, but at an explosive grade, it can be used as high explosives. So every day is spent doing something a little bit different.
Hi, Craig Williamson, will you tell us, so you have a bunch of food in your pocket right now?
Some dogs work for toys. When they find explosive odor, they get a toy. This dog happens to work for food, and he never gets a bowl of food at the end of the day. He gets increments of food for finding explosive odor throughout the day. So, yes, I'd add his rations of food for the day, his 3 cups. I keep it in the pocket that I have here, and that's his incentive to find explosives, to search all day long, is to get fed.
How does he act differently when it's time for him to work?
I would give him command to seek. And he would start searching diligently. You know, he's always in search mode.
Because he's a dog?
He's a dog, yeah. He was a guide dog in training before we got him. And he didn't pass guide dog school for this propensity to want to be curious and search. And he didn't pass guide dog school, and so we picked him up as an explosive detection dog. That, you know, that's the traits that we want. We want the dog to be curious enough to look under dressers or behind the couch or inside cars. And what he does when he finds explosive odor is he would sit and look to get fed. He wants his food. He wants increments of food. So he would sit down. He looks to get fed. I give him some food. At that point, our job is done. I'm not a bomb tech as Randy Curtis here. Our job is done. We withdraw. I provide them with the information of what I saw. Usually a bomb tech is always with me when I am working. But if I'm working on my own on something and we come across something, then I would explain the best I could what I saw, what the dog was alerting on, so they have the information they need.
What keeps the dog safe as he's looking for that explosive?
Myself and my training. There's no body armor that we use for our dogs. There's body armor for dogs, but it's the nature of the work is something that we can't have the dog in that at all times because it tends to be hot and cumbersome. And if we were going after something very specific, a specific target, and this is usually for the tracking dogs that we have on our department, if they know they're going after an armed suspect, they can take the time to put the body armor on the dogs. In our case, we're always searching for something that's, by its very nature, explosive, and it's just a hazard that we have to accept.
We wouldn't want to ever put Dennis in harm's way or Craig. A good example was a suspicious package we had the other day down at Third and Yesler when it was discovered. It would have been very easy to eliminate it if we were to send Craig and Dennis down and take a look at it, but it's not our protocol with the Seattle Police Department. It's already been deemed everyone's awareness and is heightened because of what has occurred across the country. So when we have a suspicious backpack that's already been determined, it was very easy to just ask Craig and Dennis to stand down, and we sent down 3 of our robots.
Well, that's what I was curious. So you sent the robots in
right
to do what at that point?
The robots were able to go in and open up the backpack. We sent each one down. Each of the robots have a different specialty, if you will. Some of them are great for just observation platforms. Others are great at actually manipulating packages. So we can send them all down together, working like, you know, Larry, Moe, and Curly, and they give you a different perspective, a different angle. Otherwise, when you're working with the robot, it's like playing a one-dimensional video game. You're looking on your monitor. But if you want to actually get some type of depth perception, we'll send down the other robots and set them up in just in a little perimeter around the package, and you can quickly determine then that the package was benign.
How long have you been a bomb tech?
15 years.
So what has changed for you in that time as the technology has changed?
Oh, immensely. I mean, our first bomb robot was this big clunky, I think he's like a 1,000-pound beast, and now they're faster and nimbler, can lift things. The technology, just like with cell phones, think about your yeah. cell phone 15 years ago, what we were carrying then. It's a very business-propelled industry. Bomb suits have gotten lighter, thankfully, as I've gotten older.
Do you still have to go in at some point and either disarm, explode, or move the bomb physically?
We prefer to, if we can first send in the robot, that's always the first option. If it's an environment that the robot won't fit, or it's a piece of technology, it's like your Nintendo. It'll break right about the time the game's getting good. So then we scissors, paper, rock, and the loser puts on the bomb suit, which is about 80 or 90 pounds of Kevlar and ceramic tile, and you go down with as much limited mobility, and we'll attempt to determine whether it's an actual device that needs to be rendered safe. If it's benign, then it's game over right there. But if you have to take it to the next level, we'll determine whether we need to move it or take care of it where it's in place.
Have you had to do that?
I have.
I mean, we've seen these images of bomb techs in various movies where you are face down with something that could blow up in your face.
It's just like the movies.
It is.
I'm joking.
Well, I was wondering about that. I mean, you know, what was that movie that they made with
Hurt
the bomb?
Locker.
Hurt Locker.
Hurt Locker.
Was it? Is it like that?
It's just like that, Steve.
No, it's not like that at all.
It's not like that at all.
It would be too dangerous.
Yeah, it would be too dangerous, yeah. Nobody likes that.
No.
But, no, nobody's a big caffeine junkie in the bomb squad. Everything we do is very slow, very methodical. It's not a place for the youngster. You like the old people there.
Yeah, you do like the old people there.
You'd
it
like
tells
to.
Me you're a successful officer.
I've got all
because your hair's a little gray.
I've got a lot of hair, gray hair, yeah.
All right, so has a bomb ever exploded on you?
No. No, knock on wood.
Yes.
That's on Craig's head. I've detonated a couple that have been made by people that were meant to explode, and I've detonated the package in my time frame and not in the bomber's time frame. All That's right. called a successful disruption.
Let me take a break with Detective Randy Curtis, Craig Williamson, and Dennis. And if you have some questions, you can also give us a call. This is Weekday.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Repertory Theater, finishing up its 50th anniversary with the comedy Boeing Boeing. Swinging bachelor Bernard is in for a surprise when his three stewardess fiancés all arrive at his flat in Paris. Boeing Boeing plays April 19th through May 19th. Tickets at seattlerep.org.
48 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 54 this afternoon. Forecast says it's going to be breezy with rain likely.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle pediatrician Dr. Robert Pretlow, currently recruiting 30 overweight youth between ages 13 and 21 to participate in a study of a smartphone app in a self-directed weight loss program. More information and qualifying criteria at patientecare.com/study.
947. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Paul Kevin Curtis, the Mississippi man they think sent the ricin-poisoned letters to the president and a senator, is being described as a conspiracy theorist and an Elvis impersonator. More in the news at 10 o'clock, just about 12 minutes from now.
Sorry, I was talking to the dog for a moment there, and he was in my way. That's Dennis. He's a yellow lab. He works as an explosive detection canine. Also with us is Craig Williamson, explosives detection canine officer for the Seattle Police Department, and Detective Randy Curtis, bomb technician and underwater explosives recovery specialist for the Seattle Police Department. Let me just take a moment there, because I've said it three times. Underwater explosives recovery specialist.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, so you're a diver.
I am a diver.
And you have to go down sometimes. Why are there underwater explosives needing recovery?
Unfortunately, it's a large body of water that occupies this planet. And individuals have and will continue to use it as a disposal area. And it's someone's got to go down after these objects. So it was a school that I took myself to. My wife and I started recreationally diving in 2009 and just fell in love with it head over heels and started taking every class we could. And there's only one civilian underwater explosive school that is taught right now, and it's in Oklahoma of all places. And Craig just dropped his bone. It's taught in the largest mud puddle on the planet.
Really?
It's called Lake Arcadia. They've named it, but I'm convinced it's just a big puddle that they drop a hose into every couple of weeks.
So you're not training in pristine blue water with fish swimming around. You have to train in the area where it's dark and dank and you can't see in front of you.
Yeah. The training is truly called black water, in which you can bring your hand, Steve, right up to your face, and you cannot see it.
Wow.
Once you lay it on your face. Divers are in the water for about 20 minutes. You have yourself connected to a tender online. And for that entire 20 minutes, you're in the happiest place you can be. You're humming, you're singing, whatever you need to do, because you're searching with your hands for whatever it might be disposed of.
So, now, how is that a safe way of going, searching with your hands?
You haven't come up with a better idea yet. So if you and I do that, we're going to be millionaires.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So if folks have some questions, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. You can also email us weekday@kuow.org. So we do have a couple of email questions, but let me start by saying you brought some props with you.
I did.
For the radio. And one of them is the old spy versus spy round black cannonball with a wick on it. It's a toy.
Yeah, these are all examples of items that have been left around the city of Seattle that we've had call-outs for.
Wait, these are all actual things that have been left around the city of Seattle?
Sure. So you've got the spy versus spy cannonball.
Somebody left that.
And someone gets panicked or confused and calls 911. We won't fault anyone for ever calling us and letting us take a look at it.
You've had six times since the Boston Marathon that you've been called out, according to the blogs, just since this marathon. So people have been making phone calls.
There's a heightened awareness, no
yeah.
doubt.
Heightened right? awareness.
Sure. We saw it after 9/11, after Oklahoma. And you'll never want to discourage or browbeat someone for calling 911 on anything that's suspicious. And that's what I tell my police officers, that when they're dispatched to something, if they can't articulate anything better than the hairs on the back of their neck going up as they approach a backpack, that's great. I'll take that. And I'll go down and I'll do my diagnostic on it. I've got far more protection and tools available to me versus what a patrol officer or a citizen might.
What's this black wrapped?
It's an object I made.
Object.
The other items we use for training for the bomb squad, where other technicians will have to discover it and go in and determine what type of rendering safe method they'll have to apply to it. Same with the toolbox I have in front of me here. Inside it is a pipe bomb, a series of pipe bombs and switches. So what
is that one you made, or is that one that was on the street?
That was one that I made. And what it'll have is a bunch of different switches that the bomb technicians that I work with will have to diagnose and render it safe. Instead of an explosive on the end, Steve, there's just a light bulb so we can tell when it's been successfully taken care of by our other detectives.
Red wire or blue wire?
Exactly.
Oh, they have to figure it out.
It's always red. Didn't you see Lethal Weapon?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, I learned everything about Bomb Squad from the movie, apparently.
Me too, buddy.
So would Dennis be able to smell explosives on an object like this one, Craig Williamson, which has some nails on the outside wrapped in
duct tape? Yeah, he would. He would. If the odor is available for the dog to get, the dog is going to alert on it. And these things that Randy has brought in are very stereotypical. They look like a bowling ball with a fuse coming out of it,
yeah.
A red stick of dynamite. Good thing about a dog is that, Randy will tell you, you can make a bomb out of just about anything. And so if my dog were to sit on a can of Coca-Cola, that means that there's explosive odor in that can of Coca-Cola. And so maybe a bomber has done something where he's drilled out the bottom of it and loaded it full. Or you can make a bomb out of anything. So my dog is telling me that the stuff that everyday items could be a bomb, and the dog is used for something like that. This would what I'm looking at in front of me would make me call 911 immediately.
Sure.
But if we went to a bomb threat and came upon a manila envelope and Dennis sat on it, you know, then again, I'm telling the bomb squad that.
What about that ball? Is that Wilson tennis ball there? Because somebody would try to pack it with its explosives?
Yeah, these little novelties are available year-round and are real popular. During the 4th of July, they're called tennis ball bombs.
Is that an actual fuse?
No. I wouldn't bring anything in the studio.
But, I mean, those are sold.
These are sold.
As bombs.
They'll cut them open, fill them with an explosive compound, put it back together. And kids will buy these, or the worst thing they'll try doing is making them themselves. And we've had children severely injured in the Seattle area attempting to make novelty little explosives like this. Same with the little cricket pipe bomb in front of me here.
Oh, yeah.
They'll see these on the internet and think it's cool and make them, take them out to Green Lake or any area around the city and set them off. And we've had horribly devastated wounds on kids inflicted.
That's a lot of metal that could be.
Oh, it's a lot of fragmentation. Even the tennis ball bomb itself throws off a massive concussion.
Hmm.
And if you have no idea what type of fuse that is being applied to it, it goes off with devastating results.
We're taking a deeper look into bombs and bomb inspections for obvious reasons. Let me bring a caller in. Winston's in Blaine. Hi, Winston.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Surely. I need some clarity about the idea of the pressure cooker. Did pressure within the pressure cooker, was that the catalyst for the bomb? If so, a pressure cooker needs a heat source, needs a flame, and I don't think there was a flame inside that bag. So was maybe the pressure cooker just a container for another catalyst that was inside the pressure cooker?
Yeah, that's a great question, Winston. I'm only guessing at this point, as everyone else is. There are certain details that the investigative group has to keep into themselves. But I'm guessing that the pressure cooker was merely a vessel used to contain the explosive components that in of themselves had their own initiation process, some type of timer, or remote detonation switch. I think the pressure cooker, Winston, was just there to contain all of the components.
And they just used the pressure cooker because it would supply more metal fragments, is something like, rather than something lighter, something like an aluminum, a lightweight container.
Right. It's like a large pipe bomb, if you think of it that way.
Oh, I see. Winston, thanks. All right, here's a lovely sort of last question. I like this. Kaylee writes, how did each of your guests who specialize in bomb detection, detonation, get their start, and what made them go toward this profession? What made you go towards this profession? What were you thinking, Craig Williamson,
when I started the department, everyone starts in patrol, and I immediately gravitated towards the canine unit because I enjoy working with animals. And in 1994, I started working with a tracking dog, and that dog retired. And in 2003, the department got their first bomb dog, and I was selected to work with the bomb dog. And it's been a wonderful career. I mean, if you look at Dennis,
he's a good man.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've good arguably dog. Got the best job in the department.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then how did you end up being this specialty?
You know what he left off his resume?
What's that?
Craig and Dennis. He hates when I tell this. They're actually they were recognized as our Department Officers of the Year for 2012. I think that's quite something to be proud of. He leaves it off his resume, so I throw it out there, and then he'll make me pay for it later.
Yeah.
I like that it was both of you recognized.
It was. We're a team. I have to rely on his nose to tell me. I just am there to interpret what he's telling me.
Yeah.
How did you get there, Andy Curtis?
I've been doing this for 23 years. Before I was a police officer, I was actually a flight attendant.
Really?
Yeah.
And you thought, well, if I can handle these guys, I could go into bomb detection?
It's customer service industry, baby. I did that for 10 years, and I had a lot of friends that were in law enforcement. Seattle was hiring at the time, got hired, and did just as Craig had stated, went through patrol and worked on the mountain bicycle patrol unit, which was an incredible way to make a living. You come in, and for 9 hours a day, you're bicycling all around the city. Worked in a plainclothes narcotics unit, though, prior to getting into the bomb squad. And a very good friend of mine was murdered off of the Swift Albro exit, Antonio Terry. And at that particular moment in my career, I did a lot of reevaluating and wanted to do something different. A friend of mine was a supervisor in the bomb squad, and he said, hey, have you ever thought of the bomb squad? And I told him I'd got a list of about 20 things, and it's not on there.
Why did he think you were the right person for that?
I think he had a sense of humor. He was just a good friend, and he was offering me the opportunity to try something different after Antonio had been killed. And so I tried out for the bomb squad. It's a very small unit. We have 6 detectives, 2 sergeant supervisors, and a lieutenant. And to get into the bomb squad, you have to be a detective. They have to accept you in this little group. It's like riding around in a 6-person patrol car. Does everyone's personalities match with one another? And, you know, you try on the bomb suit, and it was all a great fit at the time.
Kaylee asked by either preferred characteristics for people in this field, and she ended by with the question mark, patience. I would imagine patience would have to be
absolutely.
Not addicted to caffeine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, I appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you.
Giving us some insight. Detective Randy Curtis, Craig Williamson, and Dennis, who does a lot of the work.
He does.
This is Weekday.
C-SPAN.
Support for KUOW comes from University Volkswagen Audi, committed to providing customer care through the exclusive Passport Service Program, which includes service loaner vehicles, rideshare shuttle service, and a knowledgeable staff. More information online at uvwaudi.com.
10 a.m. Headlines from NPR News, just a minute away. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. 48 degrees in Seattle, looking at a high today of 54. Forecast says it's going to be breezy all day with rain likely.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.